for us, and I think this is true of the wider community, people are really frustrated at the moment with the politics, whether it's internal politics and infighting within the parties, or whether it's politics in the, you know, party against party. Yep. People are wanting now to have outcomes.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I am the host of this show. This week I've brought into the studio Fiona Simpson. She is the president of the National Farmers Federation. I invited Fiona in for a chat about many of the issues that are in the news at the moment, namely the National Energy Guarantee, climate change, live sheep exports, and we've also had a bit of a yak about women's participation in public life, which is a subject she and I are both passionate about. It's a big, big meaty chat, so let's get stuck in. Well, Fiona Simpson, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, I want to start with the National Energy Guarantee because the Farmers Federation was one of several business groups in town in Canberra this week trying to persuade parliamentarians that this scheme is a good idea. Can we roll back history just slightly? The NFF was one of the sort of leading voices against carbon pricing when Labor brought in the Clean Energy Scheme and the CPRS. Now, obviously, they're different schemes, but to me, the big sort of secret around the National Energy Guarantee is it looks to me a lot like an emissions trading scheme. So why was this not a good idea a few years ago, but is a good idea now?
I think a number of things. And one is that I think farm representation and farmers generally have come quite a long way in their attitude to climate and climate change and climate variability and dealing with all of these things and accepting some of the facts behind the science. So I think to start with, I'd say that we have probably turned quite a corner ourselves, and our approach now to this is quite different to what it was in those days when the leaders chose that path.
That's really fascinating to me. So you say we've turned a corner, as in the farming sector. I'm not surprised, given that farmers live on the front line of climatic variation and climate change. But what do you think has caused the farm sector to turn a corner on this issue?
I think a number of things. One is that we have been experiencing some wild climate variability.
So it can't be denied anymore.
So yeah, I think so. It's in people's face. And whilst we've had, you know, we're a land of droughts and flooding rains, absolutely at the moment people are seeing enormous swings in what would be considered usually normal. Mm-hmm. So they're getting all their rainfall at once for the year, mm-hmm. even though they end up with an annual rainfall that's much the same, it's all at once. Or it's in so many little tiny insignificant falls that it doesn't make any difference to them. And the heat, you know, we've had some record hot summers and some weird swings in seasons. So I think, you know, it's a lived experience at the moment, and it always has been for farmers. But when you couple that lived experience with what the scientists are telling us, and the science, you know, is at the point where, there's always going to be some outliers who are going to have some wild ideas that they do in any sector, anywhere. Yeah. But overwhelmingly, I think it's got to the point where, no, it's acceptable. The science is very acceptable. People are acceptable. They're living it every day. And as such, you know, we want to keep doing, you know, growing food and fibre. That's what we do, and we love it. Sometimes I have to remind my members of that because it gets a bit frustrating sometimes when you're dealing with so many things outside your control. But at the end of the day, we love what we do. We do a bloody good job at it. We really grow great food and great fibre, and Australians are really lucky to have such a great industry like we have. We want to keep doing it, but we want to do it in a way that's not just sustainable for us, but you know, making sure that we can add our bit and do our bit and try and contain as much as possible some of the effects of climate change. So it's a real experience to farmers, and I think, you know, the science, the lived experience coupled together has meant that as a result, advocacy has really changed.
Has shifted. It's really interesting. And what do you think the implications of that are for the Nationals? I interviewed David Littleproud a couple of weeks ago, and he, I suppose, exemplified that shift. Really,
yeah,
in
exactly.
terms of the comments he was making.
I think he, and now taking that approach to Agmin, and also I think the whole farmer advocacy bodies that I represent, it's very indicative of what we hear when we travel around rural and regional Australia. It's very indicative of the fact that that farming is a modern industry. It's an industry for the future that the young people and the people involved in it are wanting to place it there. Mm-hmm. They want to be looking forward. They don't want to be looking back. They want to be making sure that they love science. Generally, farmers love science. They love technology. And so they want to embrace all of that. And I will just say a little word about an ETS. I mean, I think the straight cap and trade sort of system doesn't necessarily suit agriculture. Mm-hmm. And it's because we think, and that's probably what led their thinking, I suppose, some time ago when mm-hmm. they were looking at the ETS. And it's because farming is such a strange system. Well, it's a whole system. So we do have emissions, obviously, from animals, but also from machinery. But we also have the capacity to store a lot of carbon on our farms. And, you know, there's a lot of focus on vegetation mm-hmm. and, you know, some of the methods through the REF that have been most widely used have been through avoidance sort of methods around vegetation. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we talk about a lot is the opportunity, and we see it in many of our farming industries, to actually be able to participate in a more active way. So we like to be participating in, whether we're talking about energy generation or whether we're talking about just carbon storage, whatever it is, we like to be able to do that while we're growing food and fibre mm-hmm. and have it add to our business and become part of our business, not just sort of something that we can't, you know, locking up part of our farm and not using that part anymore because it's got to be put somewhere to achieve some higher good. So,
sure.
So I think, you know, for us, cap and trade alone doesn't really work. Mm. We want to be looking at how we can reduce emissions, store more carbon, have healthier farm systems. And that actually is part of, we think, has some potential through the NEG.
So you need a sectoral solution.
We need a sectoral solution. And we also need a solution that at the end of the day, individual farmers on a slightly smaller scale than is currently envisaged by a lot of the schemes that are out there at the moment, would like to participate. So a farm is generally a sort of a mosaic, and, you know, a number of farms together are a bit of a mosaic landscape. So mm-hmm. you have some trees and you have some grass and you might have some crops and you might have some animals and you might have, you know, some other value adding maybe now particularly. And, you know, it's very hard to dedicate under the current schemes that we can sort of employ at the moment. It's really hard to get enough scale in a lot of those schemes just on your own mm-hmm. Or even just a small group of farmers. So we're always talking. Last week I was up talking to the Clean Energy Council and others about what we can do and how we can improve some of the schemes that we see out there now. Mm-hmm. So getting back to the NEG, long way around, I think the NEG for us is some sort of an ETS potentially. Mm. Mm. It certainly talks about, you know, carbon and, you know, value on that.
There will be a price.
And there will be a price on that. And yeah. there we go. But I think in actual fact, it's the for us, we've focused on the reliability, the affordability, technology neutral is really important to us. Yeah. So, you know, we think that there's a lot of opportunities for small scale energy generation, and it's already happening as a matter of fact.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because obviously that's the design of the scheme. You can see some opportunities. Specifically, what are the opportunities that
you're
seeing?
So we're still, there is, now having said that, we're comfortable with the framework of the scheme.
Yeah.
There's still some detail being worked out.
Well, it's quite a lot of detail.
In fact, hundreds of pages. The detail, I think. So still getting our head around some of the detail. But what we've put forward in our submissions is that we would particularly like to take advantage of some of the heat generation that a lot of our intensive industries are using. Mm-hmm. For example, the pork industry has been amazing at capturing methane and then using that as energy generation. You know, all the manure slurry going into big pits and covering those pits and then having the methane captured and driving a lot of technology. So, you know, things like that on farm are amazing opportunities. And if we think about pork, if we think about chickens, that's quite a good, you know, an amazing opportunity just in itself. And even that, then if we start talking about bioenergy and, you know, we start talking about technology that's probably more well known in Europe, but certainly becoming better understood here about biomass and some of the, if you think about some of the so-called waste on farm when you're talking about straw or those sorts of things, and you can actually turn that into energy. So I think, you know, a lot of our farms are at the end of the grid.
Yes.
They're not well serviced by the grid, to be honest. Mm. And is there potential, and can we make more potential to, first of all, you know, make sure that we're not just looking at one grid, we're looking at all the 400-odd grids that there are in Australia and establishing more, and what are the opportunities for regional communities and farmers to establish their own? And can we be doing that in an effective way? And secondly, what are the opportunities with an eye to, you know, to what we can do now with capturing methane and emissions and using those? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's a really exciting thing, and that's something that farmers and our industry have been doing a lot of research on in recent years.
Mm, it's really interesting. And in terms of just the politics of the NEG, I saw your comments to journalists after you came out of the meeting, the backbench committee meeting, and both you and Innes Willocks of AI Group had some fairly pointed commentary in the direction of Tony Abbott, which, well, you know, in my view, is utterly reasonable given what's gone on. But you were quite direct in terms of your referencing that internal fights should not determine whether or not this policy flies or not. That's your view of it.
That's our view. Yeah. So, and I think that's the community's view, to be honest. I represent an incredibly diverse group of industries. Agriculture, there's nothing more diverse, I wouldn't think, than agriculture.
No, well, exactly.
And yet, you know, we are able to come together and endorse a policy. We are able to see that it's something with a general framework that we can work with and that there's a lot of opportunity too. And so for us, and I think this is true of the wider community, people are really frustrated at the moment with the politics, whether it's internal politics and infighting within the parties, or whether it's politics in the, you know, party against party. Yep. People are wanting now to have outcomes. And the one thing that particularly my sector, but also, again, this is just something through the community, people are facing skyrocketing energy prices. You know, yesterday in front of the backbench committee, we talked about some of my members are facing bills triple what they were a couple of years ago. Mm. And if you're doing irrigation, it's not always just like crop irrigation, even in terms of the broad scale crops. Some of our tree crops, so we're talking fruit, nuts, vegetables, those sorts of things, they have a very slow drip irrigation that drips probably continually, you know, over a 24-hour period. Now, the cost of running a motor to do that sort of, you know, irrigation, which is extraordinarily sustainable. It's a great way of irrigating. It goes straight to the plants. Much better than spraying it around in the air. Mm. Really great environmentally, really good water use efficiency, but the cost of running the pump is extraordinary and has tripled. So we don't want, and we know that there's no one thing that's going to fix affordability overnight. We're very realistic about that. We've gone down this path for so long without any certainty. It's going to take a little while to fix. So that's okay. But we need the framework in place to do it, and until we have this framework in place to give us some certainty, then it's still not going to happen. So we need the certainty now. We want to stop the infighting. You know, whoever, whether it's Tony Abbott or anyone else, they need to think through the outcomes that the community wants. And overwhelmingly for us, it's about affordability, it's about reliability, it's about acknowledging our Paris commitments, trending towards the lower emissions. Mm. And that's what we want. We don't want to keep having, you know, bringing
another
out our generators.
Sumo wrestling match.
If they don't pass this, to be honest, we've got all, you know, pretty much all of business yesterday was behind it. Mm-hmm. You know, wide-ranging sectors of the community. There's, you know, and I think all of us come from very different places. But really, if we can't get this through, then there really isn't anything else at the moment. It is back to square one, as we've been back to square one for a number of times now. And that would be incredibly frustrating for people. So I really, as we did yesterday, urge the party room to think collectively. And to think about the outcomes for the people that are out there. We have tried very strongly, and a very strong part of our policy is that and farmers are market focused. So, we love markets. We like free markets. We actually love a lot of our 70% of our products exported. Mm. So, we understand competition and we understand markets. For us, it's important that any policy be technology neutral and that let the market decide. So, we've urged them yesterday to stop picking winners. You know, it's not about coal versus renewables versus whatever. Mm. It's a bit like a farm. We're probably going to need a bit of everything, and we want opportunities to do those in that framework, which is, you know, affordable, reliable, trending towards lower emissions. So, you know, that's, I think, there's a bit of concern in there amongst some of them about that, but that's really, surely let the market decide is the best way rather than one politician thinking what's going to be the technology of the future.
Well, I completely agree. How's it going with the Nats? Because, of course, they're split.
Yes, look, and that's one of the problems for them, isn't it? I mean, I've got to organise my group.
Everyone's herding cats.
I've organised my lot, and this is something that I think we talked to the National Party about, but clearly we're a very broad church. We have members and farmers who support all sorts of different sides of politics. We have a good relationship with the Nats. I have a great relationship with David Littleproud, and he, I think, has taken on a challenging, you know, some challenges that he's facing right now, and he's handling them in a very professional, mature way, a sensible way. And I think this is all just one of them. So I have confidence in the Nats leaders. I have some sympathy for them because I've, you know, I know that our sector has had some wide-ranging discussions to come to the agreement that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, that's their job.
Yeah. Exactly. Get on with it.
They have to do it.
Speaking of David Littleproud and challenges, it's a nice segue to live sheep, which is another big issue kicking around the place
this week,
at the moment. Yes. So it looks like everything in this building, as we both know, subject to change without notice.
Mm.
It does look, though, at the present time, that the government's not going to bring forward that legislation that Littleproud's cooked up in order to better regulate the industry, because they are concerned that at least two Liberals will cross the floor. Also, I don't know if you realise, because it was such a busy day on Wednesday, but Darren Hinch's resolution banning live exports passed the Senate as well.
Oh, okay. So, actually, that slipped through and I hadn't noticed that.
Yes. So that's kind of indicative of numbers in the Senate, which would, I suspect, I mean, I haven't...
So you're talking about the bill that's going to penalise, bring in more penalties for directors.
Correct.
That Joel Fitzgibbon has indicated he's going to put amendments to.
That's the one. Yeah. And it looks, you know, I always hasten to say, subject to change without notice, but it doesn't look like that bill is a starter at this point because of problems in both houses. So what do we do?
Oh, look, and I think it is disappointing for us, and the RSPCA and us have joined together on this one. You know, the government has decided to continue the industry, which we think is the right decision.
Do you think it's the right decision?
We do think it's the right decision, but we do think that, and we don't think, we think particularly when we have a look at 2011 and what happened then, it is about making sure that animal welfare is foremost. Absolutely. That is the critical thing. It is about making sure that this industry, like any other industry, has to have the regulation and the standards that are enforced. And I think what we've seen just this week with the Emmanuel's ban has indicated that government are willing, under David Littleproud, to enforce those regulations.
Mm.
Now, you know, whether that's something that should have happened a long time ago, who knows? You can't, you know, in my job, you know, I'd love to go back sometimes and fix some things that happened in the past, and you can't do anything about that. Mm. So for us, definitely, the market, the live sheep market, is a very important market for our Western Australian farmers in particular. It's also a very important market for the markets that they supply, who are dependent on a live sheep trade. They don't have the supply chain, the refrigerated supply chain in place. For them, I think at the moment, there is not much alternative.
Mm.
And so they would probably source. And this may or may not change in future years. Who knows?
Yeah.
But at the moment, they need... this fresh meat product, we can supply it. If we don't supply it, other countries like Somalia are live exporting a number of sheep, and their mortality rates are up around 25%. And you can imagine the conditions of some of their vessels. So I think people who are concerned, and everybody is concerned about animal welfare, it has to be the uppermost criteria. We just have to think about the fact that when we're in these markets, and we've seen it particularly in cattle, that we have influenced these markets, and we have influenced changes in the systems, changes in the supply systems in these other countries, through working with them and making sure that the Australian animals are well looked after all along the supply chain.
Mm.
So that's one of the reasons why we think that the trade should continue, and we need to keep facts on the table about what it is, you know, about the terrible footage that we see. We need to make sure that we can, that everything is in place so that that doesn't happen, and it shouldn't happen, and it shouldn't happen again.
What about, Susan Lee's been constructing a lot of quite detailed arguments, not just, you know, oh, poor sheep, my heart breaks, but quite detailed.
About the Middle East.
Well, about the Middle East and about the economics of the industry. Essentially, if you boil Susan's argument down to its essence, she basically says, if the industry is properly regulated, if the regulations are enforced, then the industry is uneconomic. So,
well, that's a decision then that it makes.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly it works with cattle, you know. So in actual fact, there are cattle that travel to the Middle East and do so under good conditions, and that seems to work fine. So I think, you know, I think we shouldn't depend on Susan Lee to say those things. I think we should see, and we've actually seen, now that the government has put out there the different stock loading criteria, for example, and we've reduced the amount of animals by a third, pretty much, broadly, on those vessels, then we've already seen some exporters have another look at where they're taking their stock and what they're doing with them, from South Australia particularly. And so, you know, the market has to make those decisions, and the exporters that are doing those trades have to make those decisions. And, you know, if places like Kuwait really want the sheep, then, you know, we have to make sure that they have to make sure that they can convey. So our standards are our standards. I think our job is to set the standards under which we're happy to have. We then don't speculate whether or not it's economic or whether it's not.
Mm.
We do need to set the appropriate standards, and then...
And it either happens or it doesn't.
And then it happens or it doesn't. But at this point in time, we know that there's a demand. There'll be a cost for some countries. The cost of our animals, because of the cost of getting them from Australia, is quite high. But they're happy to pay that because they know of the quality of our animals.
Mm.
So to me, that's the role of government. The role of government is to set very high, you know, whatever standards that needs to set around an industry, and it needs to respond to the community. And then, more importantly, and we see this, Catherine, across a range of industries now, where the regulator falls down.
Mm.
And, you know, we were still waiting, obviously, on the Moss review to see what that review comes up with. But I think, you know, once we set the standards, then there has to be ways of making sure that everybody complies, and whatever we're talking about. And there's been a number of examples lately where, you know, we farmers pay levies for this, you know, to have good regulation across our industry.
Mm.
Animal welfare on our farms is very high. The standard is very high and strongly enforced. So it seems that we need to have that everywhere.
Mm. What about a summer ban?
A summer ban. Well, the argument against the summer ban is that that is the period of most demand. I mean, we said everything should be on the table. When we first saw the footage, we definitely wanted everything on the table to be under consideration. And if we couldn't do the summer, if we couldn't transport sheep in the summer safely and with high standards of animal welfare, then we shouldn't be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's been put forward by Mr. McCarthy is a way where he believes that we still can do that. And look, there's, you know, science versus science in terms of some of these things. But we endorse the review. We endorse what he says. And at the moment, as we understand it, if we don't actually export sheep during those peak times, then the market's effectively dead.
Right.
So I think it's definitely a matter of, you know, looking and planning, setting standards, making sure that animal welfare is our highest priority, which it has to be, and making sure that then if there's outliers in the industry that are not, you know, having those standards. And I have to say, you know, it is a little frustrating that there's the sorts of good footage. There's a number of pieces of good footage out there too on social media about, you know, sheep relaxing.
Chilling
on the way to Kuwait. And cattle and, you know, we don't, but that doesn't get shared at all. And we do then see this footage, which was incredibly disturbing, incredibly disturbing.
Oh, I can't even watch it.
No, and I have, you know, producers in WA who who do participate in the live sheep trade. And we've all accepted that we need to take a little bit more interest too in what happens. I think for farmers, you know, you grow this beautiful product and you love your animals, and we reconcile ourselves. I know that people who are vegan have problems with this, but we actually reconcile ourselves that our animals have a good life and a good death. That's what we would like, because we like eating them. Mm. I mean, I know a lot of people have the problem with that, but we unless you're a vegan farmer, overwhelmingly that's what we do, and there are those. But I think we've sometimes thought, okay, well, we just wave them off on the truck, and we know that that's loaded according to specifications. We know all that, and then we have tended to a bit set and forget.
Mm.
So we have acknowledged that we need to be more participatory in the supply chain as well, mm-hmm. even though we're not required to, but we should be. If we say, you know, that animal welfare is our highest priority, then we need to make sure that we look at the boats and visit the boats and visit, talk to the exporters. And I know over the last few months, people have been doing that, particularly in WA, where they have very few options. Not nearly as many options as we have over here on the east. You know, much smaller domestic market.
Mm.
You know, sheep that, you know, over there in those conditions that really the Middle East love. We are still refining our mutton taste over here in the east, and it's going to take a while to build that up.
Mm.
So it's a huge issue, but I think it's one that overwhelmingly, if we just try and again keep the politics out of it, if we again try and make sure that animal welfare is our highest standard, if we set clear standards and then uphold those standards and make sure that people are upheld to those. If the outliers are punished, if the industry can get on with it, then I think we have to continue that way.
Mm-hmm. And I've enjoyed this yak so much, and we've gone on a bit, but I do want to ask you just one more before we wrap up, and that's about women.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. You're a high-profile woman in a masculine sector, I think it's fair to say, although, of course, farms are
changing, starting to change, and farms 50%
are partnerships,
of us. Absolutely, you know, and that's what I always say, is that, you know, even though it's a masculine representative sector,
yes,
probably, historically, yeah, although that's starting to change, you know, overwhelmingly, on the farm, everybody's partner, you know, there'd be 99% of farms are partnerships of men and women,
absolutely,
probably.
Absolutely.
So, you know, very active on the farm.
It's kind of a false binary. I've just fed you, and we both agreed it's a false binary, so let's move on from it.
Yeah.
What about politics? Would you like to see more women take more prominent roles in politics, particularly, I mean, if your interface, main interface with the parliament is the Nats, which it kind of has been historically.
Well, the ag minister, I think, changing, will always be a Nat.
Likely.
If they've got a coalition.
Likely. Yeah.
Mm.
So would you like to see the odd woman?
Yeah, I think, definitely. I must say, yesterday, with the Minerals Council and the Business Council and myself, you know, three strong women representing, you know, strong sectors of our economy.
Mm.
And
hooray, Catherine. Sorry.
And then the backbench committee was overwhelmingly male.
Mm, fancy that.
Yeah. So yes, definitely. I mean, I think we need to have a parliament that's representative of society. So not just representative of our community and the different sort of diversity within our community, but and the different views that it holds. And we know McKinsey and others have done so much research now too about, which is why I've been so strongly in trying to lead change within the ag sector and leadership, for example. We know that diverse groups of people make better decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, of course, not just gender, but it is gender. And that's an easy way to do some of that. And, you know, women and men think in different ways. We network in different ways. We construct arguments in different ways. There's all sorts of different things. And, of course, it's always about skills and what skills you have. But I can assure people that there's a huge, you know, pool of skilled women out there
mm.
that would be fantastic representatives in Parliament. But I have to say, I think when you actually do have a look sometimes at the way Parliament operates and you watch Question Time or any of those things, it's not always an environment that we would love to get into.
Well, that's really the thing. And I'm not really asking you this in a personal sense, although you may have some burning ambition to get into politics.
No, I think knitting needles has been in my, I think that's been one of my vocab in the past.
But do you think it's a barrier? Seriously, do you think it's a barrier?
I do think people people who, and I would hope that people would do it if they were seriously considering coming into politics, would come and have a look and sit in question time and look at the house and think about how it actually, what their day job would be like when they're not out there talking to the community and doing community things. And I think it would, I think a lot of people would have a second think about it. And I've spoken to some wonderful women in politics as well, people who just get on with it and say, look, that's just part of it and it has to change and you need more women to change it. And that's true too. So it's a bit of a conundrum because whilst you haven't got many women in there, it's always going to be the same. Although I have to say, it's not just, as you know too, Catherine, it's not just about women. It is about men and culture change and, you know, the whole champions of change thing, which I just love, because on the way up, as I've been doing my job, I've been supported by so many amazing men.
Me too.
And otherwise, you know, I wouldn't have been here because I wouldn't, you know, the way that these sorts of jobs works is that it's a bit who's around and taps on the shoulder. So if I'd been waiting for women, then I would never, you know, you'd never come through. So I think it's about culture. It's about acknowledging. I don't know that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily. I sit on another board where we have more women than men. And it's because of the skills and the willingness to be open and look for the right mix of people. And I think, you know, ultimately, the community expects that Parliament has that sort of diversity. It expects that Parliament is able to come to issues with outcome focused. It expects that Parliament is going to be representative.
And sometimes rational.
And if we don't have more diversity in Parliament, not just gender, but all sorts, then it's hard to see that that's really reflective of community.
Great note to end on. Fiona, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure. I've enjoyed the chat.
Good. Well, thank you so much for listening. Thank you, as always, to Miles Martignoni, our fabulous producer extraordinaire, Walkley nominee, and a recent winner of two New York Festival International Radio Awards, for another pod project for Guardian Australia called The Reckoning. It's fabulous. You should have a listen. What a legend. Of course, don't forget to subscribe. Heavens above, I almost forgot. Don't forget to subscribe. Either on iTunes or via your favourite podcast app. Until we meet again, which will be next week. Take care.